What does luxury mean to you? Is it a glass of cold, crisp wine on a sunny afternoon? A piece of beautifully hewn jewellery? Or simply a stroll in the wilderness? This edition of Confect Corner delves into the world of luxury and what it really means and how it's evolved and shape-shifted over the years. Our reporter journeys to the Champagne region to see how a female winemaker is reimagining the idea of fine fizz. We'll head to the British Museum to unpack a new exhibition, Luxury and Power from Persia to Greece, and find out how the concept of coveted and prized things is a thread that is woven into the history of humanity for thousands of years. We'll convene a panel to talk about the future of mountain life and hear from the designer Andreas Steiner of the Paris-based brand Riehr about the exquisite and precarious state of traditional alpine craft infusing his label with elegant, functional detail. And finally, our deputy editor Chiara Rimella voices an audio essay on the joyous serendipity of running into friends, the luxury of living beyond the constraints of the diary. This is Confect Corner, and I'm your host, Sophie Grove.
I think in our own modern association, our modern relationship with luxury, we've kind of inherited those tropes as well. Luxury is something to which we aspire and we covet, and yet it's also something that makes us slightly uneasy and slightly cynical and suspect.
The more you are in nature and the more you experience the beauty of it and also the vanishing beauty of it, the more you're probably inclined to make changes and to see the importance that we keep it as it is.
Coincidences haven't stopped being a happy marker in my life. The doors of more than one tube carriage have opened to reveal someone I hadn't seen in months hanging onto the handrail. And I haven't stopped engaging with people anywhere in the world when they blurt out the classic line, "You live in London? My cousin lives in London." You just never know.
Welcome to this episode of Confect Corner. I'm your host, Sophie Grove, in London. And I'm joined once more by Marcella Palak in Zurich and by Gillian Tobias here with me in the studio. Hello to you both.
Good to see you, Sophie. Hello, Marcella in Zurich.
Hello, Gillian. Hello, Sophie.
As our regular listeners will know, we like to start each episode with something that's caught our attention in recent weeks. Gillian, you've been racking up some air miles, I know. Tell us what you've been up to.
I had a return work trip to Los Angeles, and I was lucky enough to be invited to the Chanel Cruise 2023-24 collection. And it was really the dream factory come alive. It was based in Paramount Studios. And Virginie Viard is so clever because she so knows her audience. And she knows who her couture audience is and who the Chanel prêt-à-porter is. She can really let her hair down for cruise. And this show was so playful. In some ways, it was kitsch, which one doesn't associate with Chanel, but the setting in the Paramount movie lot was a basketball court, and the models just came out with such attitude that was a bit 60s LA, Muscle Beach, Venice in the 70s. And the playfulness of the clothes was just completely seductive. And I think this is an ode to how clever production design can be to really get you in the mood. It's the music, it's the CinemaScope movie behind that really creates an atmosphere that makes you actually want to experience then the retail, be it the accessories or the shoes or the clothes.
It's interesting how brief some of those shows are and the impact, essentially theatrical spectacle of it can be very kind of raw in a sense. You leave like you've had a theatrical experience.
And that's why the production values are so important, because it has to leave an after image. Because the shows are so short, it really has to have such a strong impact that you leave with memories of pieces or shows or a feel that you then want to take it to the next level. They're very clever business-wise. They invest a lot in it, but it is well worth it in terms of returns. Marcella, what about you? What have you discovered for us?
So the Zurich Museum for Gestaltung just opened an amazing exhibition about the Swiss luxury fashion brand Acris. It's actually the own Swiss brand showing at the Paris Fashion Weeks, and the exhibition gives a fantastic insight in the creative work of the designer Albert Kremler. It shows the inspiring artworks like from Thomas Roof or Imi Knoebel, Gaeta Baitescu and more, beside the collections. And that's an amazing, this experience. And I discovered my favorite look. It's a long apron with a bare back and has a matching trousers in a soft mint green. An amazing summer look. And actually, it's an homage to Alice Kriemler-Schoch, the grandmother of the designer who founded the company 100 years ago. And she started actually with chic, understated aprons because she thought, okay, we have to make something out of it when we are wearing it in the kitchen. Today it's different. For me, it would be a very cool fashion look. So don't miss this great show in Zurich.
I mean, it's fascinating, Marcello. We went to the Acre studio in Paris after one of the shows and we talked to Albert about the apron kind of theme that was in a previous collection a few seasons ago, and I think it pops up. But actually, this practical roots of a luxury brand is quite interesting to explore creatively for him.
Yes, I mean, his materials and everything, it's so perfectly done. I always think it's so comfortable, wearable, but in the same time, it's so luxury. I think it's quite difficult to bring those aspects together in design, and he's really a master in it. And how about you, Sophie? What do you have for us this month?
Well, I've just been to Photo London, which is an incredible show at Somerset House on the Thames. And it was set up a few years ago to kind of rival Perifoto, which really takes over the city in spring. And I think Photo London is really getting into its stride. And the opening night is always such a wonderful sense for London of, you know, the seasons on the turn and people are down by the water and you meet everybody in the photo world mingling around. It's a really nice sense of celebration.
I think what's really interesting, what Photo London has shown, is that there now is this very buoyant market for photography, which is getting stronger and stronger, from artistic photography to photojournalism. And that breadth of what you see in Photo London is quite inspiring, isn't it?
It's inspiring in the sense that the curation is kind of left up to each pavilion. And in some ways, that's a good thing. There's something for everyone. I was most drawn to the Photographers Gallery collection, and they had this amazing three or four pictures by a photographer called Fouad Elkoury, who is a Lebanese photographer. And it's his early work. You would have loved it, Gillian. It's like these picnics in the 1960s with women in these huge, wonderful raffia hats and eating bowls of fruit. It's kind of déjeuner sous l'herbe, but kind of Levantine. And then there's an amazing picture, which is called Marwan Dives, which is somebody diving into this beautiful, it's black and white, but you could tell the water's crystal clear. And it's this essence of summer. So I felt that was really something that seduced me. But then, you know, the Martin Parr was the kind of guest of honour, this great kind of chronicle of British seaside culture. So that was interesting. But then you also have this kind of very commercial, very savvy sense of what to buy, who are the collectors. And I think that's, it's very real, it's very good, but it keeps the show very current. Whether you've flicked through our magazine or simply been a regular listener to this podcast, you'll know that Confect has a deep admiration and perhaps a slight obsession with the abundant craftsmanship and glorious nature found in Europe's mountains.
From the Dolomites to the Engadine Valley, we're always searching for the entrepreneurs and creatives who are continuing to strengthen alpine communities and keep old traditions alive. But change, and particularly the impact of climate change, is shaping the future of mountain life.
To find out more from those living and innovating through these changes, I caught up with Andreas Steiner from Riere, an incredible clothing brand who works directly with local craftsmen and women in the Alpine regions, and Aurelia Sternemann and Leah Herlemann, the owners of Casa Alpina Belvedere, a new boutique hotel based just south of St. Moritz. I started by asking Andreas about growing up in the Alps and just how much it has changed over the past few decades.
It changed quite a lot, and I think maybe the most interesting part is how the population also changed in just the last 50, 60 years with my grandma or that kind of generations. They grew up, you could say, even like in middle age, because there was no telephone, no cars, no communication through one valley to the other. If they had to visit friends or family that lived a little bit further in another valley, that today we can do by cart in 10 minutes. That was really once a year maybe, and they had to walk or go by horse, and it would be like a full day trip. So there was a development of this difference with all the valleys from the distance. So I think what really changed and what was the point of this, that today with connection just through the phone, of course, but also the car and travel and tourism, etc., it has completely changed from really middle age into like a modern kind of lifestyle and society. So I really refer always back to this childhood experiences that I made with a farming family with no electricity up in the mountains, 2,600 meters, with animals around just running outside, not having no fridge, using the cold water source outside as a fridge to put the yogurt. And I mean, it's a completely different life. So I kind of like that two extremes that kind of balance themselves out. And I try to balance themselves out by what is my old experience and what is the new reality.
Leah and Aurelia, well, it's interesting that you are relatively newcomers to the Alps, you know, as business owners. But what you've inherited is this very traditional Alpine hotel or cabin. Tell me about how Casa Alpina Belvedere was run when it first opened. And what were the sort of values back then, the interaction with nature? And how has that changed in terms of the modern perspective on the mountains?
So actually, the Belvedere has been open for over 100 years. So it's always been a retreat for many, many people and also many famous people. Writers and artists came there, and we really wanted to cultivate the spirit as well. So like to host artists again this day, that they come and create something up there. So we host concerts, also always have an art exhibition in our house. So I think that's the parallel that we wanted to keep to back to the early days. But in general, even before we opened it or in the past, the Belvedere was really a secluded place, which is still now. And I guess it always brought people back to nature when they went on holidays there. And it was really, really secluded place with a lot of power by the surrounding alpine nature.
I mean, Andreas, one of the themes that's already emerging is this idea of sort of this lack of connectivity, which in some ways was a deprivation in the past, but actually led to some very rich culture and particularly craft, which is something that you've been trying to restore and revive with Rier, the brand that you run. Tell me about that as a philosophy behind the brand, because you worked for Prada, for Miu Miu, you were, you know, in the world of luxury, and then you found this kind of calling to go back to South Tyrol and really inject some life and modernity, in a sense, to these beautiful crafts that were slightly dying out.
When I stopped working for Louis Vuitton in Paris, and I had a moment that I was traveling back home and I didn't work for a few weeks and months, so I started looking around for old craftsmanship. And I started going to the markets and seeing all these old costumes and remember what my grandma always told me about how to treat the wool and what would be the benefits of these natural materials and how it was made. And there were so many interesting stories that I felt were very relevant at the moment, because you speak about the luxury industry, which I felt not very luxurious anymore in a sense. Items are leaking quality. They are just made to be entertaining with like strange colors, strange pockets, no real use because it's not really wind repellent. It's not really water repellent. It's just for a look. So for me, that was not interesting. I mean, it was just not relevant in time. So also I thought if I would start a brand, it needs to have something else and it needs to have these kind of values that I referred back from remembering in the mountains, that you really needed to have clothes that work. And you needed to be ready all the time. So a kind of interesting analysis of the wardrobe that we are building for the brand is that growing up in the mountains, I grew up in a verticality that, for example, people that live in the city, they don't refer in the same way. Because me, for example, in summer, we can go down into the city in Bolzano at 500 meters altitude, and there can be like 32 degrees. In the mountains, whereas my village is 1,100 meters and you have already like 26 or 25 degrees, then a little bit up, it's on 2,600 meters, 2,400, and there can be 10 degrees. But if the weather changes within the mountains, is very fast. Sometimes it can even snow in summer, and it can get very cold very soon. So you needed to be kind of ready, and that's why you wear shorts, but you needed to build in layering your look all the time so that you still have a sweater in wool, or you still have the fleece, what we always use, but you can open it with a zipper. And this practicality and functionality, combining it with the style that you can then wear also in the city, that was a little bit the goal of what I wanted to do.
I have a vision now of striding through some wonderful valley wearing just that. But let me ask you, Leah, I know that sustainability has been really key to what you've done. I know that it's also community. It's the idea that you set up shop, but you engage with your local producers and you try and foster a sense of community. Tell us about how you've built up that network.
I think it's not possible to be authentic if you don't work together with what is around. We are just working together really closely with the producers from the Val Poschiavo. That's the municipality we belong to. We are just always in quite a close contact to the local population as well. Also, it's just really different living there compared to a city, because you talk to the people and like everything is possible by just you ask people. You are so much closer. You don't have to go through like a huge process or something. You just go to, I don't know, Luigi and ask him, hey, we thought we want to do a concert. Can we use your meadow or a venue? And then he says yes. Or we want to grow a certain vegetable and we couldn't find a producer. And then we ask some other contacts, hey, do you know someone who grows this kind of lettuce or whatever? And then we get a lot of contacts who are willing to grow this specific vegetable just for us. So it's like in the end, you have to talk to people, and by that you grow this community, just a really small place there.
I think that's so interesting because it's very much the sense of that ancient community that Andreas was talking about, where word of mouth is so powerful and that connectivity is still there. And it isn't an email that you'll drop to a corporate sort of line. It's all about rapport, essentially. What I think is really interesting about your venture is that you haven't made it ultimately very luxury. There's still shared bathrooms. There's still this sense of beautiful old furniture and timber clad rooms. You feel that the sense of connectivity with nature is more important than all the trappings of luxury. And I wonder why you think that's important, and important for mountain culture as well.
The place itself holds so much power. The surroundings are so, so powerful. And we just don't want to overpower this by our concept or putting a concept there that doesn't fit. So our goal is really just to underline the beauty of the place itself and to keep its authenticity. And I think we can only do this by keeping it very minimal and very simple and really giving people access to nature and letting them be as close to nature as possible. And that is why we keep our concept very simple and we have very curated menus and don't offer that much of a, let's say, very luxurious experience in a traditional way.
Now we could talk about this for probably hours, but I have to wrap up soon. But I really want to ask all of you a question about climate change and, you know, looking forward to mountain culture. What do you think needs to happen in the mountains, Andreas, to really ready these communities for changes that might happen? I mean, over the last 30, 40 years, we've seen the whole region pivot towards this sort of winter sports, all based around snow seasons and this abundance of snow. I wonder whether we'll have to really see a sort of recalibration of what mountain life really means in the coming years and how you think that should be done.
It's an ongoing process. It's just now getting really a problem because already now in the mountains where we thought, okay, we have the glaciers, we have water sources. I mean, they are not there forever. We can see last year I was walking with a friend of mine to the glacier where I went when I was 14. It's around 3,500 meters. It's the highest hut in Südtirol. And the glacier, it's completely, I mean, it's so small now and it loses 6 centimeters per day in summer. I think there are 130 meters left in the deepest part. So then the water will be finished. So already now with this big, big tourism, in these small villages, they have to bring water by tanks sometimes because the local population doesn't even have water from the sources anymore.
And Leah and Aurelia, it's very interesting that you encourage people to hike up to your lodge. The footprint is as light as it possibly can be. But tell me about how important you think that is to maintain when you're engaging with a mountain community and setting up shop, how important that is to the wider industry for you.
Well, we were, especially last season, faced with changes which the Alpine region will face in the future a lot. So we are actually constantly in contact with our visitors about all those topics of glaciers which are melting, because we also did not have enough water last season. We have our own well, but it ran out. So we actually had to fly water to our hut to be able to continue to be open. Because of that, we had a lot of restrictions as well. And it's the future of the mountains will face a huge challenge. And winter is already not anymore maybe the strong season, but also summer is getting dry as well. So it will be a tough challenge, and it's really important to talk with all the visitors that they are aware of the changes as well.
And it feels like at the moment, maybe on another note, that contact with nature is so important to people's mental health and this sense of being in the moment, being outside, and you're giving people that. You're encouraging this sense of essentially a close contact with a sort of wonderful, sublime sense of nature. I wonder how important that is to also balance that sense of beauty with these big, long-term and huge, overpowering thoughts about climate change. How do you make sure that that's a balance for your guests too?
So we could really see last year that when we talked to people about the challenges we face and how nature changes, that it really struck them somehow and also made them think about how we can impact those changes as a society and as humans in general. And I think people really started to think about general habits they might have. And I believe it's really important that people have this connection to nature to really feel that we need to preserve it. And as the more you are in nature and the more you experience the beauty of it and also the vanishing beauty of it, the more you're probably inclined to make changes and to see the importance that we keep it as it is.
And Andreas, I think that's the same with your brand in the sense that the more you encourage people to really consider their garments, to this sense of precision dressing and the nuance of beauty and the mountain craft, the more they savour and protect and restore and love those garments. In a way, it's like a virtuous circle.
I think when you live in a city and have a very abstract kind of life and very digitalized and are very far away from nature, maybe that's also something why I like this decontextualization of clothes, bringing these kind of concepts that I grew up with and these small craftsmen and the love that they put in these clothes for a client that lives in a different lifestyle. And I think when I see what people tell me, that they wear now the clothes all the time because it's so comfortable and it's just natural material. So it's mostly wool, cotton or silk. And the body really reacts completely different to it. So it's a very comforting feeling. So maybe that is also something that I'm kind of bringing nature in a different way close to your body.
So that was Andreas Steiner from Rier Clothing and Aurelia Sterneman and Leah Herlemann, the owners of Casa Alpina Belvedere. Some really interesting threads there and some more sobering comments too. Marcella, let's just get your take on Andreas and this incredible brand. Where did you first come across his clothing?
First time I've heard about Rier was in a taxi in Paris when talking with Tyler about Confect number one. Then we had a great road trip story written by Daphne Ezard in our launch issue. And finally, I've met Andreas in his small personal showroom in Paris Marais, where I go regularly since and say hi to him and discover beautiful new pieces.
I think everyone on the Confect staff has got one of his gilets, and we have to almost ration them when we wear them, so we can't wear them all at the same time. Gillian, I think the main thing that came out of the conversation with this idea of authenticity, whether it's integrating local craftsmen and women into fashion ecosystems or running your hotel sustainably, the solutions to problems mountain life faces have to be a lot more than just box ticking.
Well, absolutely. And we used to go on holiday to Switzerland for several years to a little village called Kandersteg. And now I go back with my sisters every year. And decades later, what's extraordinary is they've been able to maintain an old world Swiss feel without feeling touristy. Like, this isn't put on. The young generation really are true to their heritage and their roots. So you see the waitresses in dirndls and Swiss costumes, but it's not really for the tourists because the Swiss will go there as well. And it's not just a ski resort. This is hiking, walking, meadows, and very much meals and cheese and breaking bread are just part of the ritual of alpine life. And there is this authenticity. And given it's very hard to find beautiful, beautiful, picture-perfect places that aren't touristy, and I think Switzerland manages to find that balance because they're very, very true to their heritage and the younger generation as well. So this isn't just the older generation desperately trying to hold on to the older ways.
Andreas has been very interesting in recontextualizing some of the kind of costumes or, you know, traditional garb of the mountain that have been actually quite synonymous with conservatism, traditionalism, and he's sort of given them this fashion edge, but also sort of slightly punk edge. And in a way, what he's doing is trying to kind of bring them out of the context and bring them into the urban sphere. But I think it's really powerful in a sense, because then they take on this new life. But then when you put them back into the mountain, you realise they're just useful, beautiful, of the earth. The idea of a walking jacket, I mean, for me, how much more wonderful would it be to holiday in that than a fleece? I mean, I'm a bit anti-fleece, but like, wouldn't you say, Marcella, there was also a return in Switzerland to the essence of walking, really that close contact with nature, the study of the flowers in summer? It doesn't have to be about the thrills of mountains and the kind of verticality and velocity of winter sports.
Yeah, the summers here in the Swiss mountains are being rediscovered, I think. It's really like many years ago, there was hardly anybody hiking, but now there is like a lot of people hiking, and sometimes even difficult to find a path somewhere where you're alone. But I love the idea that especially the younger generation, they discovered hiking as holidays, as something doing together.
And Sophie, we're just about to feature Casa Alpina Belvedere in the next issue of the magazine. What drew you to that?
It's a beautiful story for us. You know, two women who, you know, they were really just searching for a project in the mountains during the lockdown, and they came across the lease for this old lodge. I think it was pretty much derelict. And then they just went with their kind of modern sensibilities, but preserving some of the really lovely elements. So it's a really community up there. The meals are communal, shared bathrooms even, which is kind of unheard of in modern hospitality. They're keeping that sense of the old-fashioned hiking hut. You know, in a way, I feel that sometimes luxury travel can alienate people from nature. And in this way, you really give somebody something that will really restore them. It's a holiday that kind of, it's healing and it's adventurous. And in a sense, for me, that is really true luxury. So that's one of the reasons, isn't there? And now, the idea of the status symbol designer bag is not even a century old, but the concept of luxury and the power it wields has ancient origins.
To explore this, a new exhibition at London's British Museum, Luxury and Power, Persia to Greece, looks at how specific luxury items shaped the political landscape in the first millennium BC, but also the problems such extravagance posed.
To get the full picture, Confex Paige Reynolds took a walk around the exhibit with lead curator Dr. Jamie Fraser and sent us this report.
Tucked away at the top of the British Museum's iconic marble staircase is the Joseph Hotung Great Court Gallery, which from now until August 13th is home to an exhibition which lives up to its grand setting, Luxury and Power, Persia to Greece. Through a collection of objects and key historical moments, the conceptual exhibition interrogates the role of luxury as a tool of political power in ancient times. Just before we delve into the finer details, lead curator Dr. Jamie Fraser talks about why the exhibition is so crucial for understanding luxury today.
Our historical record was written by Greeks. So when we look back at the Persians and the role of luxury, we're doing it through Greek eyes. And the Greek tropes for this, they look at the luxury of Persian living. And the implication many of them find is that, well, no wonder the Persians lost. They'd become softened and corrupted and weakened by luxurious living. Not like us, the Greeks. It's a part of a construct. We're simple living, we're plain living, we're self-restrained. And I think in our own modern association, our modern relationship with luxury, we've kind of inherited those tropes as well. Luxury is something to which we aspire and we covet. And yet it's also something that makes us slightly uneasy and slightly cynical and suspect. And I think the origins of that modern relationship toward luxury go all the way back to the boundaries between the ancient Greek and Persian world.
The first of the exhibition's three intimate rooms deals with ancient Iran, the opulent Persian Empire. The sumptuous tents of ancient Persia, evoked by draped hangings around the sides of the gallery walls, and of course an abundance of the colour purple. Jamie explains the importance of the Herodotus quote staring back at us on the opposing wall.
Treasure there was in plenty, tents full of gold and silver furniture. When Pausanias, the Spartan general, saw it, with its embroidered hangings, he could hardly believe his eyes. Now, this is an important quote to have in the exhibition, I think, because it does two things. One is that it does describe, quite accurately, the opulence and the sumptuousness of the Persian court. But the other one, the key word there, I think, is eyes. It's telling us that we're viewing the Persians through the eyes of the Greeks. And what we're trying to do in this section is strip it back to those objects themselves and look at how these objects work as objects of luxury, because actually they had a very necessary purpose, and that purpose is all about statecraft. Because as the Persian king was inviting everyone to his tent as the focus of feasting, what he's doing is using luxury to bind hearts and minds to the imperial authority.
As we circulate the room, the most interesting thing is not the objects themselves, although the gilded rhytons, ancient wine-pouring vessels, are quite something to behold, but the way in which these objects were emulated throughout the empire, both by other wealthy people to justify their own political authority, but also by people from lower scales of society who were reaching up and trying to mimic forms of Persian luxury that the king would have used.
This case that we're standing in front of does two things. We've got a rhyton and a gold and a silver bowl and a silver wine strainer along the top. And these are all the sorts of objects that you would quite comfortably find in the Persian court. But underneath these, we have also a rhyton, two bowls and a wine strainer that look very similar. In fact, some of them look identical. But they're made in clay, they're made in bronze, they're made in much lesser, cheaper materials. And the ones along the bottom were found actually in a tomb, or several tombs, from a cemetery called Deve Huyuk, which was a Persian period cemetery near a site called Carchemish on the border between Turkey and Syria. These were excavated by Lawrence of Arabia. What's quite extraordinary, I think, is that you see a Persian soldier stationed on the boondocks of empire still choosing to be buried with exactly the same sorts of stuff that the Persian king would use, but they're done in different materials. Those gold and silver objects on the top, they're the Rolex watch that the Persian king would wear. The pottery and the bronze versions at the bottom, well, that's the sort of Rolex watch you can buy outside Tottenham Court Road station. Luxury is as much a sort of an aesthetic style that moves vertically between classes as it was horizontally across the ruling classes of ancient Persia.
Move into the exhibition's second room, and we find that luxury in ancient Greece, or more specifically ancient Athens, was a more complicated beast.
Over the course of the 5th century, Athens becomes one of the most wealthy cities in Greece, and in fact anywhere in the Eastern Mediterranean. And so you've got this political democratic system that's evolved in part as a reaction to the social inequalities that preceded it. It's then grappling with this philosophical and, frankly, practical problem of, well, what do you do then with wealth that's flowing in to this new democratic city. And you can see one of the answers on this sculpted relief that we're standing in front of now. It's made of marble and it's from the East Frieze of the Parthenon. And the East Frieze depicts a procession called the Panathenaic Procession, which was an annual religious procession where everyone from Athens would parade through the streets. There was a 12-metre high gold statue of the goddess Athena within the temple, and the climax of that parade would be to drape over a particular cloak called a peplos over the statue of Athena, and that cloak had been made by the women of Athens through the preceding year. So this is a really big deal for the city. This slab shows five young women as part of that procession, and the leading figure is holding what looks like, frankly, a large microphone like she's about to do stand-up comedy. But what that actually is an incense burner. These were associated with the rarefied, high, luxurious courts of the Persian East.
So if the objects were so linked to their now conquered enemy, and also to an ostentatious display of wealth that didn't chime with the city's newfound democratic values, why is it permitted at such a ceremony, one clearly meant to unify the city?
Luxury was made okay if it was there for the glory of the city, so kept in the repository of the Parthenon to be brought out as trophies through these annual parades. And we have an inscription in Greek next to this Parthenon relief that is actually an account by the treasurers, who every year had to give an account of things that was inside. So they would be listed by weight, because of course these sorts of luxuries were ready to melt down and used for the defence of the city or for the glory of the city should it be necessary. So what we see essentially is that movement of luxury from being a tool used for the political authority of the Persian king to one that is made all right if it is there for the glory of the city of Athens itself. In so doing, perhaps, the Athenians have democratized luxury, making wealth available to everyone and wealth available as a communal, shared experience.
As we reach the final room of the exhibition, a vibrant luminescence emanates from the central glass case. After conquering the Persian East, under Alexander the Great, Greek, Persian and local styles of luxury were blended to help define a new style of rulership. Jamie tells us more.
What you're looking at are nine magnificent, spectacular and really quite dazzling gold vessels. These were made in about 300 BC, so a few decades after the death of Alexander. So this is known as the Panagurishte treasure. They are a drinking set par excellence. They present a moment of drama, I think, as people come into this last section and are confronted so spectacularly and so suddenly by this vast, incredible gold wealth, in the same way that those Greeks would have been confronted by the luxury on an unimaginable scale when they captured the Persian command tent. But also, it contributes extremely well to the story that we're trying to tell, and in particular, the hybridization of luxury styles in this part of the world at this time. You'll see the form of these vessels, these Rhyton vessels, they look quite Persian. Some of them, for example, a spouted wine amphora, this is a jar with rising handles shaped as centaurs with a bulbous body. That's a very Persian kind of shape. But the decoration on them is very Greek. You see Greek themes such as Paris judging the beauty contest between three Greek goddesses, depicted as iconographic scenes around the necks of each of the vessels. So you've got things that look Persian and yet things that look Greek and yet also things that look perhaps local Anatolian or even local Thracian coming in and out as well.
From gilded vessels and their trying imitations to the ebb and flow of ostentatious wealth, the exhibition tells a compelling story of the power of aesthetics and reminds us that our complicated relationship with luxury is one that is likely to endure.
A report there by Paige Reynolds. You're listening to Confet Corner. Now, Now it's time for a toast. As the weather heats up, nothing says summer like a cold glass of champagne on a balmy evening. And there's a new generation of all-natural, handcrafted champagne on the scene, made with organic grapes and no pesticides, fertilizers or chemicals from vine to bottle.
Fiona Perrin is the CEO and founder of Champagne Rendezvous, a new champagne brand that promises nirvana in the form of bubbles. The champagne is low intervention, 100% vegan, and crafted in small batches.
Comfex Laura Kramer met Fiona in the French city of Reims, the unofficial capital of the Champagne wine-growing region. Let's join them.
I'm in Champagne country, just a 45-minute train ride from Paris. And I'm here to meet one of the up-and-coming stars of the wine world, Fiona Perrin.
I'm originally from Lyon, the gastronomical capital of France, where, you know, many chefs and actually women chefs, the mère lyonnaise, you know, the mother of Lyon, how they call them, were started to cook and to basically spread the love of French gastronomy from. So I grew up with this French culture and this kind of passion maybe for food and wine, mainly from my grandparents.
At 14, Fiona moved to Montreal, where she finished her studies and eventually graduated with a marketing and management degree. At the time, she didn't expect she'd end up working in the wine business, but she found her calling after an exquisite meal, perhaps unsurprising given her gastronomical background.
It was my birthday, and I literally fell in love with what was happening at the restaurant, so the experience, the food, the wine, and I realized I had passion for taste, for colors, for all world experience, and I decided after my business school to take on my sommelier certificate and to jump in the wine world. The champagne world had always fascinated me. It's the king of wine that is known through, you know, worldwide, basically. So I knew from day one that I wanted to work in the champagne business. And there would have been many experiences in between my graduation and the time that I create my champagne brand.
That journey took 10 years as Fiona worked in the wine world and eventually in champagne houses. After being immersed in the champagne market, she noticed a lack of options in the natural champagne space. So she decided it was time to take the decade of knowledge and start her own brand.
Rendezvous Champagne was born 3 years ago. It's born out of a partnership with one of our top natural wine grower in the Montagne de Reims, who works exclusively in Premier Cru vineyards. So we work really exclusively with our grower partner. That is really a family vineyard, sixth generation working the land. And he's also, as me, basically, he's really part of this young generation breaking the code. And he just don't want to do, you know, just champagne to sell bottles. It was really about having another project. So together we crafted three exclusive cuvées, a brut, an extra brut, and a rosé. Here we really have, we wanted to have an approachable kind of champagne, but at the same time we have something that is so accomplished, very complex. Even though we are non-vintage, we are talking about champagne that rests for 4 to 5 years on the lees. So at first you really have this kind of bursting fruits with really juicy aromas, and all the range is in between this contrast of nice aromatics, flavors, and also this yeasty kind of woody and toastiness on the palate. So we really have this thread through all the three cuvées that I would say maybe is the signature of the brand. Something that is very important about natural champagne is the amount of sulfite, and this is something that we don't really think about it, but you know, I had so much women basically telling me, oh, I don't drink champagne anymore because I get headaches, you get a little bit of sleepiness. So of course you have other factors that really gets this in the wine, but sulfite is really one of the main factor. In champagne you can go up to 150 or 80 milligram of sulfite per liter. And here, when you talk about natural champagne, we use like maximum 35 milligram of sulfite per liter. This is like just traces, basically a dash of sulfite just for stabilization, for transportation. it makes a huge, huge difference. And I always say to customer, I encourage them, take a mass-produced brand, take a brand that you know, commercial brand, and taste this side by side, or grab our bottle, and you will see how you feel at the end of the day. It's much more digest, there's much more purity, you don't feel that heaviness of alcohol, and it's just crazy how your body reacts, and for me this was super important.
Fiona says one of the most famous characteristics of champagne, its bubbles, can also be one of the most off-putting for newcomers to the sparkling wine.
You really need time to be able to taste through the bubbles. It's not easy. Take time, be patient. The top tip is to taste, and to note what you like. You will define more and more your style. Are you a more like a Pinot Meunier kind of person, which like, you know, bursting of fruits? Are you more like a Chardonnay, Blanc de Blanc person, which likes more minerality, acidity? So I recommend to taste as many champagne as you can, be interested. And also my recommendation is come out of the big brand, because we are stuck with always the same brand. And our project, when we released Champagne Rendezvous, it was to show that something else existed, you know, in the world of champagne.
In terms of pairing, Fiona says there have been some big changes in the champagne world, and she's got some unexpected recommendations.
Champagne is a little bit more expensive than regular wine, so it's maybe the wine that you can pair anything with. French fries, with truffles, this is my heaven match, because you have the fat that cuts really through the acidity of the champagne, the truffle that comes behind it, which is of course one of the star match with champagne. Fried chicken that you want to give a little bit more fanciness with some more high-end products like truffle, it really works. Caviar, I would say on special occasion, it's definitely what you want to do. But otherwise, what I love to rediscover is, for example, our extra brut. I love it with, you know, different type of crudos on vegetables. It's really low sugar, so it really goes with this kind of pairing that is more, you know, fresh and more approachable on aperitif, on shared plates and things like this. Rosé, for example, it goes, you know, on meat. You can really redefine what is rosé champagne, you know, with steak, with a good piece of meat, because it has the body to handle red meat too. So you can really play and have fun. It's really the wine that you want to pair, you know, anything with champagne.
For Confect Corner in Rons, I'm Laura Kramer.
And now it's time for this month's final thought. Taking a chance and putting yourself out there can lead to beautiful new friendships, or some interesting encounters at least, as Confect's deputy editor Chiara Rumella found out.
It was a few months after moving to London when I realised that I might have to give up on coincidences. The statistical likelihood of bumping into someone you knew, discovering friends in common, or paths crossing in a capital this big felt too little to really get invested in. Growing up in a mid-sized city such as Turin in northern Italy provided plenty of fodder for this type of fatalistic observation. It made it even a bit too easy. Life there felt defined by a casual force. Days flew by, milling about with friends, fleeting from one informal meeting to the next, rather than being constricted by strict plans written in a diary. And yet, to my surprise, coincidences haven't stopped being a happy marker in my life. The doors of more than one tube carriage have opened to reveal someone I hadn't seen in months hanging onto the handrail. My best friend and I are joined by a network of improbable connections that extend through different decades and countries. And I haven't stopped engaging with people anywhere in the world when they blurt out the classic line, "You live in London? My cousin lives in London." You just never know. Perhaps one of the most elaborate instances of international happenstance occurred just a few weeks ago. I was in Ibiza for a report, on my own, and over drinks at the guesthouse bar I realised that the woman staying one room down was the person who had been sitting next to me on the plane. At the host's encouragement, we ended up having dinner together, then going for a long hike the following day, and then for lunch after that. Over the course of a day or so, we discussed families, love, ambitions, sharing the kind of deepest, darkest secrets usually reserved to the closest of confidants. When the friend she was waiting for finally arrived on the island to join her, we parted ways, each satisfied with the impromptu connection we had made. If I've told this story to a few people already, it's because I love it when fate intervenes in our plans. In a life that feels like a confusing tornado of events, these sorts of encounters give me something to hold on to, a sense of greater meaning, a little pinpoint on a blurry map. Sometimes they can feel as potent as a spiritual revelation. But the incident also taught me something else. On the island, people talk about a sense of friendliness, freedom and openness, as though Ibiza only attracts supremely welcoming souls ready to bond. The reality is that many visitors become friendly and welcoming once they get there. They get invested in an island mentality that loosens their limbs and allows them to be the open personalities that they can be. If I had finished up my drink and jumped in a taxi to go elsewhere for dinner, rather than striking up a conversation with my hotel neighbour that evening, the coincidence would have simply slipped us by. It's not easy or practical to make space for the surprises of life back in rain-soaked London. Sometimes coincidences need to grab you with both hands to be noticed. But the next time a branch appears in the whirlwind of the everyday, I'd like to think that I would stretch out my hands and at least try to catch hold of it.
That was Convict's very own deputy editor, Chiara Rumella, musing on the beauty of a brief encounter. Julian, have you ever had a similar experience?
Well, yes, because that is the beauty of travel, I think. And I was in Florence on assignment with our lovely colleague, Emma Nelson. We went to this beautiful little simple restaurant that had been recommended by the River Cafe. And next to us was this Italian couple. And we chatted and chatted again about love, family, life, professions. Amazing evening. Left, ended up exchanging numbers as you do, but didn't think anything of it. The next day, Emma goes off to Pisa Airport. I'm meant to go to Florence and my flight is cancelled. And Emma had been texting this woman just to say, thank you, lovely to meet you, and that was it. And she just said, poor Gillian is stuck in Florence, her plane's been cancelled. Next minute, I get a text saying, we hear your plane's cancelled, come for lunch. They invited me to the most lovely home in an area I'd never been to in Florence. Their children were there, they cooked me pasta, they made me a lovely tart. And it was so special to be in someone's home in Florence, just by chance, these people we'd met the other evening. And I go to lots of very special places to eat, but that was one of my most memorable meals.
That sounds wonderful. Marcella, is there something to be said for a fleeting friendship? Just these moments that happen and then, you know, no one follows up.
And what if a fleeting encounter becomes a lifelong friendship across countries? What is the chemistry of this encounter, the secret of attraction? I'm thinking, I have a friend in Italy whom I met many years ago in Zurich's main station, so nothing special at all. But until now, after many years, he's my soulmate forever. And I'm often thinking, what was this magic of this moment that now lasts for many, many years?
Oh, that's really wonderful. I think Chiara's essay sort of touches on that, in a sense, the idea that there is an alchemy to each encounter. And in fact, there's a sort of strange destiny to it as well. But I think also for me, the way she talks about just the lifestyle of when she was raised in Turin, people were kind of buzzing about, just not diarising, just using that kind of wonderful serendipity to kind of guide them in daily life. So you just meet people all the time. And I was actually in the park at the weekend, and a friend of mine from Tel Aviv came up and said, this is what it's like in Tel Aviv. You mill around, you just go to places, your friends are there, they happen to be outside the bar or in the square. Then you just spend the whole day kind of popping around, meeting everyone you love. I suppose what big cities teach you is that everything has to be booked. And I think it'd be wonderful to be liberated from that and maybe just fall in love every now and then. Like you, Marcella, platonic love.
No, it's not the love story, actually. No, it's really friendship. So that's what makes it special, because, like, I don't know what happened, but it wasn't love, but it was like, I don't know how to call it, a soulmateship, something like this.
It sounds profound and wonderful. That brings us to the end of this episode of Confect Corner. My thanks to Julian Tobias and Marcella Palek. Confect Corner is produced by Carlotta Ribello and Paige Reynolds and edited by Christy O'Grady. You can reach us at audio@confectmagazine.com. The summer edition of Confect Magazine is on shelves now. Remember to subscribe at confectmagazine.com. We'll be back next month with more, but until then, from me, Sophie Grove, goodbye and thanks for listening.